This is Charles Johnson, April 27th, 1992. Necessary Wisdom, The Challenge of a New Cultural Maturity.
If at any time during the evening you can't hear me clearly, just wave your hands frantically. I won't be offended, and I will up the volume of my voice. Because I know when I get really into things, sometimes it doesn't carry all the way back there. Very much a pleasure to be talking with the C.G. Jung Society. My training as a psychiatrist is not formally Jungian, but I have very deep Jungian roots. As a child, I grew up in a community primarily of visual artists and musicians, and Carl Jung was a major source of inspiration and wisdom for that community. So I suspect I would not be doing what I'm doing today in lots of different ways were it not for those early connections and connections through the years with Carl Jung. Well, I'm a psychiatrist by training. More often these days, I'm referred to, for lack of a better term, as a futurist. One of those people with the audacity to think they can make some sort of sense of what's happening in the world these days. I work with groups of people pretty much across professions, educators, physicians, artists, political leaders, religious leaders, helping them identify critical emerging questions in culture and grapple with what they are asking of us. Actually, futurist is not the best term for what I use, or not the one that I like best. My favorite was invented by an old friend from college who has a very precise mind, and we were talking one time over lunch, and I was trying to explain what I was doing, and it doesn't fit into easy categories, and he said, "No, I don't understand. He gave me a call a couple of days later, and he said, "I figured out what you are." And he said, "You're a cultural psychiatrist." And I've taken up the term. I really like it, in the same sense that when I work with individuals, I'm interested in the health and the growth of the psyche of the individual. In my work as a futurist, my interest is in questions of the health and the growth of the psyche of culture. Well, how's the psyche of culture doing? Well, clearly in times that are asking a lot of us, as participants in the cultural psyche. More and more we use words like crisis. We have environmental crisis, crisis in education, crisis in healthcare, crisis of confidence in governance. And at least as I see things, as we look at those myriad crises that challenge us, they share a common unsettling characteristic, and that is very few of those crises seem to be adequately dealt with simply by working harder at what we've done before. They're asking, at the very least, new perspectives, frequently much more than that, asking new values, and asking new ways of being. And what I'd like to be doing this evening is, in our short time together, take something of an exploration into the question of what are the emerging questions of our time, and what are they asking of us? And I think I will speak relatively briefly, 40, 45 minutes or so, because I'd like to have the larger portion of that in conversation, because I think much of what our time is asking is a conversation. To set stage a bit, I might offer a quote by Eric Neumann. So I was just reading The Origins and History of Consciousness a couple weeks ago, and I think it's pertinent to the task. psychology having penetrated to the collective layer in its investigation of the individual psyche, is faced with the task of evolving a collective and cultural therapy adequate to cope with the mass phenomena that are now devastating mankind. One of the most important objectives of any depth psychology in the future is its application to the collective. To kind of prime the pump, I want to toss you a question, or a couple questions. First of all, I'd like you to just reflect through your life now and identify two or three issues, concerns, problems, questions that you feel that we as a culture, we as a species, will be needing to give attention to in the years and decades ahead. Pick out two or three and ones that are particularly, in fact, important to you. They could come from anywhere, from issues of child rearing, intimacy, community, politics, environment. Pick out two or three that are important to you. Now, for each of those that you've noted, ask yourself, what's your best sense of what each of those issues or problems or questions is asking of us? Okay? Is it something that could be solved simply by spending more money on it? Note for each one. Would that take care of it? How about passing a new law? For each that you've chosen, can you accomplish part of it, all of it, by passing a new law? If neither of those, what is that question, that issue, that problem that you've identified? What is it asking of us? If someone asked you to articulate it, what would you say that it's asking of us? We'll just let that incubate and we'll weave back to it. Okay? There's a notion that we use a lot at the institute I directed that I call pressure point questions, which is simply very ordinary, even obvious questions that if you look at them all closely and push them hard, it's like they open one into some new territory. They're not addressable within old terms. Somebody at the Institute calls them Toto questions. You're not in Kansas anymore questions. So I think what I'd like to do is just toss out a montage of a few Toto questions to sort of juice things a bit here. Where shall I start? One intimate to all of us in our lives, and that's a question of how do we make love work? Okay. Up till relatively recent times, we had a formula for love that we could be fairly confident in. We had gender roles. And I could be fairly certain that if in my growing up that I did a good job of learning my gender role, there'd be some people on the other side of the room who were learning their gender role, and like two pieces of a puzzle fitting together, we could meet and live relatively happily ever after. Now we can be critical about gender roles. I'd make the argument that gender roles were, in fact, one of the most amazing inventions of the cultural psyche, because they allowed human beings to engage in this very vulnerable and scary and demanding thing, which is getting to know closely another real human being. They allowed it to happen without us having to know the other person very well at all. Okay? And it seems the case that for most of us, we're at a time where that simply is not enough to make something love anymore. there may be parts of us that will fall for hoping that we can find the white knight or the fair maiden that's going to complete us and make us whole, but we can be relatively confident that if we fall for the seduction of that, that there will be another part of our psyche that will reach in underneath and pull the rug out from underneath us and have us land flat on our face. Our times are asking more in love than we've had to bring to love before. I think, you know, the challenge simply is, which is something that's not been necessary before in the history of the species, or possible before in the history of the species, to begin to engage in what does it mean to love this whole people? What does it mean to literally love another person as a whole separate person? So, at least as I see things, we're being challenged to turn the first pages in a next chapter in the story of intimacy, in the story of love. And it's tricky territory. It's scary territory. I work a lot with couples around these kinds of questions. And one thing that seems very important to say is we are taking baby steps into new territory. We're pretty bumbling in our ability to love as whole people at this stage in things. We're just infants at it now, and probably at the time that we die, we'll still be just toddlers. And we have to be comfortable with the fact that the reality we're in is that large. It's asking that much of us. It's asking us to be that courageous, but also have to have that kind of patience with each other. It seems to me, with that kind of reshaping of relationship is happening not just in intimacy, but it's happening in every kind of relationship. It's happening in terms of how we relate between parents and children. Okay, it's happening in every kind of authority relationship, of teacher to student, of a political leader to populace, of doctor to patient. I know in my training as a physician, things were just starting to change. People were just beginning to grapple with that either or. In my training as a physician, but it was very much the time still where there was a strong element of what we wanted the doctor to be was to be the expert, and we wanted the patient to be patient. And we're not comfortable with that anymore. We need something bigger. We're being asked to move into a new territory. But what is this new kind of relationship? Authority is coming to mean something different than it did before. Expertise is meaning something different than it did before. New territory, taking baby steps in it. So, one Toto question. Let me grab a real different one. Let's talk about medicine. Let's play with healthcare a bit. The question, how do we have an equitable and affordable healthcare system? Okay, how could you have a that's about as different a question as you could get. I say, well, I'm not sure it's that different a question. There's some interesting threads. Let me tell a story. Had lunch about a year ago with a wonderful, big-hearted bear of a man who just stepped down as Deputy Minister of Health for Canada, and he was very much instrumental in shaping Canada's healthcare system. And over lunch, he turned to me and he said, Charlie, you know, you and the United States are looking a lot toward Canada as a model, possibly for your healthcare system in the future. And he said, you know, I think there's some truth in that. We're making some important headway. But there are also ways in which perhaps you're misguided, he said. So we're doing wonderful with the first step, and that's making healthcare universally available to all. They said, you know, we're just beginning with the second step, and it's scaring the daylights out of us. And that has to do with making healthcare affordable. Because to make healthcare affordable means to deal with limits. It makes us grapple with the fact that with increasingly expensive healthcare technology, the simple fact is if you want to make a healthcare system workable, you have to ration care. You have to say everything is not available to everybody. Okay, on the surface, that sounds like, well, that's a difficult question, but that's basically something for healthcare administrators to deal with, and I'm sure they can work it out. But he turned to me and said, look, the reason we're having a hard time with it is the whole concept of rationing care pulls the rug out under from our most basic assumptions of what medicine is about. You know, the story I grew up with to become a physician was that I was the white knighted warrior who was fighting death and disease at largely any cost. He says if we're going to ration care, we have to move from medicine being about fighting death to a new reality in which very frequently we're choosing death, in which our relationship in health is not the white against the dark, the life against the death. But our story has to do with a new ability in a much more systemic and mature way to make choices about meaning and life and health within a larger whole of life and death together. New territory, much harder decisions, not the black and white kinds of things that we had to rely on before. The cultural psyche is saying, can you turn the next pages into a next chapter? And it gets even more complicated than that, because what happens when you begin to say, well, we'll ration care, we'll pay for some things, we won't pay for other things. One of the first things you say is, well, you know what probably makes sense is for us to spend more money on preventive care. Great. I agree. And then the question becomes, well, what's preventive care? And you go, well, certainly things like better prenatal care is good preventive care. Okay. How about nutrition? How about toxins in the environment, cleaning up chemical waste dumps? Okay. How about the health of communities? How about education? Okay. Suddenly, this question, which we thought was about how much money to spend on different kinds of surgeries, suddenly has us thrown into the midst of this larger question, which is, what does it mean to have a healthy society? And we're asking the whole ball of wax question. And somebody can say, oh, come on, let's get back to medicine. I mean, what are we dealing with this question for? And I turn to them and I say, no, the question that's being asked is just what the doctor ordered. Take a fresh big picture look at what makes us healthy and what is going to make a healthy future in the choices that we make. Challenge to turn the next few pages in new territory where we don't have some of the handholds that we've had before, asking a new maturity of us, a new courage of us. One more total question. And maybe I'll just pick one that sort of encapsulates them all. I think one of the and an obvious one, but let's throw it out there. And that's the question of progress. So the total question is, what's progress? Okay? And it's useful to think about, because if we went back 50 years, there wouldn't be any question about what progress was. There might be a question whether we could progress, but there wouldn't be a question of what progress was. Progress was new inventions and material growth. Okay? An expanding gross national product, new inventions, making new possibilities possible. Okay? Well, clear we're in time now where if we continue to use that definition of progress, it will be totally our own undoing. That definition of progress will not be progress in the future, okay? Just like when you're a child, you can't keep being a child once you've moved into adolescence. There's new rules that define it. So you have to make a step. There's a step that has to be made. So we're a situation where clearly we're dealing with real limitations in terms of resources. We're dealing with limitations for space for the effluvium of civilization. We're having the ability to invent things that can do irreparable harm. So that definition of progress won't work. So what do we do? And we tend to get tossed into an either or with that, which is either let's deny that it doesn't work and desperately try to go onward and upward within the same trajectory. Or on the other hand, because that's the definition that we've known, we're thrown into despair and depression because there does not feel like an option of where to go. And I would say that probably, if you were going to ask me what is the fundamental task of our time, the fundamental task of our time is a conversation that we're engaging in, which is really a redefinition of progress. Because progress is the human concept by which we say what makes something more. Okay? And in each stage in the evolution of culture, we've had a notion of if you do this and this gets bigger, it makes something more. Now we have a new conversation, which is what do we want to have more? Okay? What would be a future that would have us feel like we had been good ancestors? Okay? And that's the fundamental question of our time, not just within progress in an economic sense, but in terms of how we think about each of our professions, how we think about parenting, how we think about love, how we think about the future in general. We're in a new kind of task of being engaged together in writing a new story, writing a new human story. So what's going on? Why this new challenge? I mean, I remember when I was in seventh grade in a science class, and I remember learning about the wonders of the emergence of the scientific age 200 years ago, and reading about Newton and reading about Bacon and all of this. And I remember with some sadness thinking, wouldn't it have been wonderful to be back there in those times when they were really fundamental questions, because all we have left in our time is just this finishing and polishing of little details and things to do, you know? And, one should be careful what one longs for. I mean, who would have guessed 30 years ago that we would be in times when really, in most every aspect of our lives, we were being challenged to re-ask the most fundamental questions. Okay, to re-ask the foundation questions in each domain of our life. What a wonderful gift, but also what a scary and unsettling thing to be forced into. What can we say about, at this point, what can we say about this next chapter that we're moving into, these first few pages that we're turning? What can we say? I think one important acknowledgement is, at this point, what we can say is limited. And it seems like a very important acknowledgement, because I think one thing our times is doing is asking us to redefine expert. Because an expert has been somebody who has the answers for us. And to me, in these times, to me, I think the greatest mark of an expert is somebody who has the courage to admit how little we know about what the next steps are about. That has me trust somebody when I can hear them articulate that. It also tells me they have the courage to hold things as big as they are. And that, to me, is the definition of value and wisdom. Okay? So what I think we can do at this point is that we can begin to identify a few threads in the fabric of where we're moving, a few common themes that seem to go through the changes that are happening in different spheres. And I might take some time to do that, at least some of the threads that I see. There's also a thing, it would be absolutely wonderful to do, but we really can't do at this time, which is really to define fully the task of this next stage. Because it's wonderful to have an image of where one's going. If one doesn't have an image, frequently one will go into denial and not even be willing to take on the task because there's so much uncertainty in the task. But I think we're too early into this next chapter one to have images. I think there's also a sense, which I can come back to later, in which this chapter doesn't have images in the same sense that chapters in the past have had. But I think what I might do is share at least, if not an image, the best I can do at this point that works for me, which is a kind of analogy, a kind of developmental analogy. And I'll use it to kind of weave the threads together a little bit. And it's a developmental analogy that a group of people with Jungian sensibilities should find some kindredness with. And that's a developmental analogy to the time of midlife within our lives. Okay. And Jung was, I think, the most eloquent expressor of the challenges of midlife. And then there's some very fascinating ways in which the last epochs in the evolution of culture were very much like young adulthood, and the challenges now are very much like the challenges of midlife. And I put that not as an answer, but simply as something to hold on to make some sense out of the slippery territory that we're in. So let me weave some threads together, and we'll just see how many feel right to do. What's being asked? One thread. One thing that's clearly being asked is a new kind of maturity in how we grapple with all the questions of our lives. And, you know, for example, in the area of love, well, we have uncertainty within our individual lives in love. We've always been able to count on the notion that the culture had some definition of love outside of ourselves that we could rely on. We didn't know whether we'd be successful at love, but we knew what being successful at love looked like. Okay? In healthcare, we didn't always know whether we could be healthy, but we knew what it meant to be healthy. Okay? So we have uncertainty within our individual lives. But there's been an absolute truth and knowing provided outside of ourselves within the cultural psyche. We didn't know whether we could be successful, whether we could progress adequately, but we had no question what progress was or what success was. In many ways, it's like our relationship to the psyche of culture was like parent to child. It's like the culture was a parent to us as children. Okay? Now, I would say that's an artificial separation through the entirety of the evolution of culture, because we have always been both the cultural psyche and the individual psyche. But I would say that's been too big a reality for us to hold. But part of our task now is a growing up within the cultural psyche and a taking of a new kind of responsibility within the whole of the psyche of culture that we have not had to take on before. It's very much like midlife. Midlife is a time where, once and for all, we let go of parents. We let go of them physically many years before, but we have held on to them psychologically and spiritually up to that time. It was still myself and that external existence. Okay, what happens at midlife? Part of it is to say, oh, my parent's just a person. And with that, a kind of owning of this authority that I've needed to give outside myself in order to be safe. I mean, it's critical for a two-year-old to perceive its parents as gods. It needs to see them as gods in order to have a safe enough feeling world to be willing to move in. Okay. Now we're at a time in a similar way in which, at least as I see it, we're being asked to bridge between the personal psyche and the cultural psyche, to hold things as large as they are, and in that to take a new maturity without those final certainties that existed when we had culture as parent. We begin to take responsibility in culture as a creative process. Okay. One thread. We have another thread. And that is, in every domain, no matter where you look, we're being asked to think about truth in new ways. It's not just that truth before has been an external thing, and now we're having to meet it more personally. It's also the case that truth before has been form-defined. It's been something we can lay out on the table and say, this is it, and add it up. Okay, so I had that clear formula for love. I had gender roles. Okay, I had that clear formula for success in health, and that I could defeat death and disease. I could add up the gross national product to get progress. I could define education in terms of what I got on my tests and how many facts and skills I acquired. Well, interestingly, we're moving into territory in every domain, and it really asks us to let go of some familiar handholds, where the measures that we need to use don't have simple litmus paper tests like that anymore. So what's truth in love in a whole person relationship? Okay. Well, on some level, truth in love in a whole person relationship is an expression of my courage to feel what is uniquely alive and right between myself and another person, and to somehow find the way to structure a relationship that honors that. Okay? And there aren't right words for it, but it's a larger process. What's truth in health? Okay? Is it just how many years you live? Okay? No, what does it mean to live a healthy life? Well, it's a life that somehow feels purposeful to you. But what's purposeful? How do you know purposeful? Okay? But that becomes the kind of questions that we're asking. The midlife analogy can again be helpful with that, because if we look at young adulthood, in fact, it's a time where we tend to define who we are in fairly form-defined ways. It's the time when we make our place in the world. Okay? And so in young adulthood, we ask, well, who are you? And we'll tend to get answers like, well, here's my profession, and here's who I'm married to, and here's who my children are, and here's what I believe in. Okay? Well, then what happens at midlife is one's assumption in young adulthood is that one will live out the rest of one's life as simply a refining of those things that one has finally created for oneself as one's unique identity in young adulthood. And one moves into the second half of life, and the rug gets pulled out from under that, because you begin to grapple with the fact of your mortality at midlife, and you realize you can't take it with you, any of those things. So what begins to define truth in the second half of life? Well, it's some variant on the question of when you get to the pearly gates, or whatever you get to, what are you going to want to say about your time on this planet? And that's the bottom line. And everything else only matters as it relates to that bottom line. And that allows the passage that the second half is about from a reality that is based largely on issues of knowledge and achievement to a reality that is increasingly defined to the degree one can make that passage on wisdom. See, the challenges of our time really are challenges of purpose. Okay? Of us really asking, as a species, what are we going to want to say about our role in time on the planet? That's in the large sense. And I would say that even the smallest challenges that we have to deal with are fundamentally questions of purpose in a new way as well. Okay? I'll give you an example. Just one example. That's the drug crisis. Okay? At least as I see the drug crisis, I don't see it as a crisis of morality in a traditional sense of good people doing bad who should do good. Basically, what I see is a situation in the largest picture. There's lots of elements and ingredients to it. But in the largest picture, what we're seeing is a situation where a significant portion of our population is choosing to ingest substances that mimic real purpose, that mimic real aliveness, that mimic a life that has real human love and connection, that has real nurturance, that has real creative excitement, that has real achievement in it, that mimic that rather than taking the risks inherent in experiencing those things as the real things. Okay? Well, why is that happening? And I would say a major reason that it's happening is that we are lacking a story adequate to inspire taking those very, very real risks. Okay? It's like we can't tell our children to just say no unless there is something very powerful to which we can challenge them to say yes. Okay? And the story that we have had, the American dream story about what it means to live a meaningful life, one, folk intuitively get that within its terms, in decades ahead, most people are not going to be able to succeed at it in the sense that many of us have. But more important than that, most people get intuitively and often very unconsciously, but they still get it. An adolescent's task is to be the shadow of our time and get what we don't get. Okay? Is that they know that even if they'd won at it, they'd lose. Okay? So the task, you know, to me, if you want to deal with the drug crisis, the challenge of the drug crisis is having the courage to have the conversation that is a shaping of a story to which when our children hear it, they go, that's something I'm willing to live my life for. Okay? Without that, anything else is just band-aids, as I see it. So, a second thread. One thread, a new maturity. A second thread, a new, more meaning-centered, aliveness-centered kind of definition of truth in the place we go. A couple more threads quickly. A fascinating one is limits. There's a way in which we're being challenged to grapple with limits in new ways, in which we're being challenged to meet new kinds of limits, really. And the analogy to midlife is, again, really useful. I mean, certainly midlife is a time when we meet limits. We have all kinds of limits we meet as we're adolescents when we're growing up. Here's a challenge to do this. Can you jump over this fence? The task is to jump over it. And we meet limits, but our task is to transcend them, and most of the time we do in youth. And that's the success of youth. And then at midlife, we begin to grapple with limits that are of a different logical type. They're not to be transcended. They can't be transcended. We begin to face our mortality. And with that we are not going to be able to accomplish everything in our lives. That's simply true. We begin to face that physically we can't do some of the things we could do when we were 20. In youthful terms, we're not as beautiful as we were when we were 20. Okay. Well, what do we do with that? Well, in our usual notion of limits, what our options are is either to transcend it or to fail. Okay? And if that's how we see things, at midlife we feel desperation and depression because those are our only two options. Okay? But what happens at midlife around limits as we grapple with those limits? And that is they start taking on a very, very different coloration. And those very limits that we saw as the obstacle, as we saw as the thing that would keep fulfillment from being possible, become precisely the teachers of the developmental tasks in the second half of life, which is wisdom. And we learn it through the conversation with those limits. Okay. Very interestingly, in our time on the planet, we are meeting limits. And I would argue that on myriad fronts, they are limits of this new type that we meet at midlife. They are limits that are not conquerable. And what do we feel when that happens as a species is we get thrown either into denial, we don't want to look at this, okay, it changes the game, or we get thrown into desperation, cynicism, and depression. okay? And we get thrown back and forth. What kind of limits are we having to deal with? Well, certainly ecological limits of all sorts, okay? And some of those will be able to be dealt with new technologies, but many of them simply not dealable that way. We're dealing with limits on all fronts of a fascinating sort, which is limits in the recognition of what one human being can be for another human being. Okay? In whole person love, one of the most important elements of whole person love is realizing that another person can't be your answer. Okay? In moving toward a more mature relationship to leadership, the most frightening task in that is recognizing that that leader is not going to be your salvation. Okay? And it goes exactly in the other direction, it goes exactly the same way. The leader has to realize that the follower is not going to be the leader's salvation. Okay, so it's a dealing with a real, that's not a limit to be transcended. That's a limit that exists, and to the degree we can own that reality is that big that it has those kinds of limits, then it challenges us to move into a larger and mature relationship to life. Other kinds of limits. One of the most interesting ones is limits literally to what we human beings can do, you know? And much of our story through culture has been the heroic story that the next challenge is to be taken on, and we can do it, you know. And I think we're coming to the challenge of really having to face that there are limits to what human beings are capable of, and having to face that. One of the projects that the Institute I direct is going to be taking on this summer is doing a major international think tank on nuclear waste disposal. So I've been getting up to speed on that stuff as quickly as I can, because I'll be facilitating much of that. But one of the pieces that has most struck me as I've been working with that is that we're going to be looking a lot around new technologies for nuclear waste disposal, but I think to a very significant degree the most likely outcome we're going to find is simply that there ain't no good solution. Okay, I mean, you really think it through. We're dealing with substances that many of which remain dangerous for 200,000 years. Okay, and almost any solution you come up with is dependent on having stable governments and having stable economies. Well, in the history of civilization, the longest stable government has been 200 years. Stable economies less so, and in fact, civilization, as we know it, has only been around for 8,000 years. Look at what we're talking about here. We're moving into a reality in which we are capable of creating things that we can't manage. Okay, and there's a humility. You know, if we're in the old heroic options, all we can do is conquer it or fail. But there's a third option. And that's humility at the face of that very real limit. And to the degree we can engage the humility of that very real limit, it can take us into the kind of wisdom that the future is requiring. And I would say that's the developmental task of the future, is asking those questions by which we find our connections within a new kind of wisdom as a species. And in fact, our future is dependent on our ability to do that. One more thread. We could do a whole bunch, but one more. This one's a little controversial, but it's interesting to weave in around the midlife metaphor, and that is that if one looks through the last 100 years of history, one of the interesting themes that appears to be there. Is a kind of beginning of a process of remembering, in the sense of certain sorts of sensibilities that were very important to us as a species in the very early times of culture. Again, seen. Okay. So remembering, we're finding ourselves bringing a new attention to the environment, not just in the environment in terms of resources, but really looking at the environment in terms of the environment as home, as something that nurtures us, that's that source in some kind of way. Well, we looked at earliest times and culture. In fact, nature was the divine, was the sacred. In the last century, we've seen a beginning of a remembering of the feminine, in certainly in the women's movement, and also in more archetypally feminine sensibilities, and more receptive being parts of ourselves. And again, look over the course of civilization, we've really moved from a time where the archetypally feminine was dominant in the early nature religions, moving through the course of civilization through an increasingly archetypally masculine patriarchal sort of reality, okay, up to this time. And now there seems to be a kind of remembering going on. Other kinds of parallel rememberings, reconnecting into our bodies in terms of bringing the body into psychology, reconnecting into the mythic, you know, which Jung was the beginning voice for that. And of course, mythic is a primary language of truth in earlier times of culture. Okay. Well, what's going on with this? And I think it's an interesting question, and it's an interesting sort of tricky place, because to me there are a lot of, in sort of pop psychology and pop spirituality, there's a lot of kind of funny misinterpretations that happen with that. There's a kind of sort of almost regressing back to making those old realities the real reality. And as I see it, something pretty different, if it is what's going on there, is what's going on. And the midlife analogy can help again. Because I think what we're seeing is not a regression, but we're seeing a moving forward into a new kind of maturity. One of the interesting things, if you look at individual development, is that one of the things that most marks the first half of life is that we have amnesias for the stages that we've just moved beyond. So adolescents have a very difficult time making sense out of childhood, even though they were just there. Okay? And young adults are totally befuddled by adolescence, even though they should be the world's greatest experts on adolescence. Okay? Well, what's happening? I would say, well, a very significant creative thing. These doors are closing so that one will not fall back into the safety of a known reality. So there's those amnesias that happen. Well, then an interesting thing begins to happen at midlife. As I see it, in a sense, the structures of personality have become sufficiently formed that there isn't this fear of sliding back down. And what can happen at that time is the beginning of a kind of anamnesis, a kind of those doors opening back up, and us beginning to see the larger story of our life, and not just see it, feel it in our tissues, the larger story of our life. And much of that remembering, not just in terms of memories, but in terms of sensibilities and ways of seeing the world, is again much of what the second half of life is about, and much of what wisdom is about. And we find this very interesting phenomena with that, is that in terms of that, for example, people in their latter years of life tend to really understand the reality of children much better than parents do. Okay? Because there's been a reconnecting into that part of themselves at a deeper level. And much of that is the task, and much wisdom comes out of that. So there's one possible way of looking at what's going on with the fact that we have these interesting rememberings and recognitions of the importance of a reconnecting with the sacred, a reconnecting in community, as we move beyond our individualistic definition of what makes something important. I mean, community very much a part of the values of early times in culture. Okay. Not a going back. Okay. Not a going back. I mean, if there's anything that, you know, if there's anything we are needing, it's not childishness. Okay. What we are needing is maturity. And that's a very, very different thing. It's infused with those forgotten parts. Okay, but it isn't those forgotten parts. There's a huge difference. Okay. So what's our task in all of that? What's our task as participants in the cultural psyche right now? I think, like it or not, like it or not, we get to be pioneers. Because that's when we are. And if there's a task, I think it's both a humble and courageous task, and it's the task of conversation. It's the task of meeting within our professions, meeting within our families, meeting within our own souls, meeting in the political arena, and saying, what really matters? Asking those questions of meaning that the second half is about. And having the courage of the uncertainty that's inherent to that territory, but also being willing to not hold back from that task. I just end with a story. I mentioned I work with people from a lot of different professions, and I worked about, this was about 9 months or so ago, with the chemistry department at the University of Washington around the future of chemistry and chemistry education in the next century, and basically just got the whole faculty together, and we did a day-long piece together. And there was one moment that was particularly poignant for me. And it started with one of the faculty in a really disgruntled tone, but saying something that was really important, saying, you know, I just think the students are just so apathetic. I don't know how to teach them. You know, a really important sentiment. Some of the teachers are really feeling right now. And then another person spoke up and said, you know, I think it's less that the students are apathetic than that they feel powerless. And there was a pause in the room, some truth there, some acknowledgement. And then from one side of the room, someone said, you know, I think we feel powerless. And it was just, it's like the taboo statement had been made in the room. And you could feel people squirming in their chairs, but a lot of feelings starting to happen. And it was a special moment, so I jumped on it and I said, you feel powerless? I mean, if anybody in our culture should feel powerful, it should be you. I mean, here, most of you are tenured faculty at a prestigious university. Most of you are male. You're scientists. You're not over there in the literature department. How in the world can you feel powerless? And it was a fascinating question to start playing with. It's like that was the thing, that was the ghost in the closet. That was the taboo. They felt powerless. What did that mean? We play with that for a moment. And I just, because I like to turn things around, I said, what would it require for you to feel empowered in what you're doing? Okay, let's just work on that. Let's forget the whys. Let's just ask that question. What would it require? I had people just think inside themselves and feel and write some things down and that kind of stuff, and took some real time with it because it was such a special moment. And then I had people share, and one person said, well, one thing that would make us feel empowered would be if we were talking to each other more. Just by the way we do research, we tend to be off in our labs doing our research, and we don't talk with each other very much. Okay? And I said, great. I said, what would you be talking about? Okay? And what really started happening, people saying, well, we'd be talking about whatever are the emerging questions in chemistry. Okay? And that was starting to get a little juice to happen in the room, but it was still pretty tentative. And then someone said, you know, I think it's not just the new questions in chemistry. He said, I think we're having to deal with a whole new kind of question that we haven't had to deal with before and really scares us to deal with. But it's what we have to be dealing with. I think the critical questions in chemistry are of a new site, new kind. They're not just scientific questions, but they're questions of value. They're moral questions. You know, the benchmark moment of that was the Manhattan Project. Here you've got the best scientists, the best physicists in the country working on building the bomb, and they get to a certain point and they say, stop. We cannot continue doing this technical work unless we're willing to ask the question of the implications of what we're doing and the role of what we're doing in the larger picture of things. And what we began to talk about was the recognition that every question in chemistry is now a question of value. It's now a moral question. It's in terms of being able to create things that can do significant harm, but also that there's very limited monetary resources available these days. Where are you going to do it? What are you going to use it for? The old story of the pure scientist just seeking into the unknown does not continue to work. Well, in this way, we sort of had this conversation that began to say, well, what are these important questions? And what do they ask of you that you haven't had to brought to that question? And who would you bring into that conversation? And folks said, well, we're going to bring the philosophy department in. We're going to bring some of the psychology department in. We're going to bring some of the literature. Those kinds of things started to happen, and the room started to get juicy because the real questions were being dealt with. And at that point, I turned to folks and I said, okay, how does the room feel now compared to what it did 2 hours ago? Do you feel disempowered? No, we don't feel disempowered if somehow we can continue working with that. And the next question was, is there a way that you could be having this conversation and have the students be participants in some way in this conversation? I said, I bet if you can do that, you're not going to have to worry about having apathetic students. So I think in all spheres, our task is a basic kind of conversation of soul, a conversation of purpose, a kind of conversation about what is a story that we can share in that would infuse our life with meaning. That's our task, that's our new kind of heroism, that's what we're here for now. So I will stop there. You like to take a break, right? So we'll take a break. We'll get back in how long? 10, 15 minutes. And bring, when you, those who want to stay, when you come back, bring your questions from the beginning of the session, and let's play in conversation together with that. Also, if folks get books and want to have me sign, I can do that in the break as well. Could you close that window so I get less traffic noise? Oh. No. Well. The task is conversation, so let's have some. And we'll just improvise it and see where it goes. Did I see a hand? There.
My question has to deal with the whole nature of the individual society and talking about change and transformation that is happening on a larger scale and the sense that the forms aren't there yet. What kind of advice and insight do you have for those people who feel like not that they're ahead of it, but that they can't plug in the way they are? I mean, I'm one of those people, I can't plug in my way.
Okay. Great. That's a wonderful question. The question has to do, I need to repeat this so it gets onto the tape. The question has to do with advice for people feeling not an immediate place to take action in the culture out of their felt relationship with it. I think there's two important questions in that. The first one is you want to be real sure in your exploring of yourself that your feelings of being out ahead of the culture are in fact that. Okay? They're all going to be totally different. Okay? And the other one says, well, it's all happened before. Okay? And I would say they're just falling off the left and right hands of the same creative question, which is, no, there is a next chapter that we're being challenged with, and that asks, it does ask some things that are new of us. And maybe one of those new things is a kind of remembering as well, but there are new things that are being asked. Great. Let me respond just real briefly, just a couple of things. One is, to me, one of the things that is wonderful in our time is what we can learn from people in other cultures, and particularly if it has to do with some earlier substages in culture. And one thing you found there was community in there, and what that helps us do is say, what is missing? What more would we want? Okay? Now, I think what one finds in that is always this two-handed thing, because we easily romantically go back and we denigrate what we have off of that experience. We very easily do it and get quite adamant about it. But I would say, off of that experience, okay, great remembering. Here's this importance of community that's one of the most critical things for us to have, both community and the open space for the serendipitous connection to happen with other people. I'll say, you betcha. That's one of the critical pieces with all kinds of implications. And then I'll say at the same time, most of the time I want people to phone before they come over. No, you won't. I'm going to finish. I'm going to finish. Fine. Okay. Fine. There's less sense of boundary within that earlier reality than there is in present reality. And I happen to like the amount of boundary that it's available for me to have in present reality, in which I can say no, and that's okay. So to me, part of the task becomes, how can I create a reality where I can have that sense of individuality, distinction, and boundary that I need, and I can also have the community, the connection, the creative open space that I want. Similarly, within the place of media within culture, you can bemoan that here we've had community, and now our primary, quite honestly, for a whole lot of people, their primary sense of family and community is turning on the tube in the evening. You know, it's the folks on the evening news or Good Morning America is their family. You know, that's the community, and that's a very sad thing. At the same time, I would say, I'm really excited about the possibility of global communications. I like what CNN does in terms of getting me information from all over the world. So, how do I move into this space in which I'm able to make use of this some immense possibility of information without simply being overwhelmed by info glut, without simply losing my sense of connection and my own unique creativity and soul in that at the same time? How can I have that global reach and deep connection with other people? And that, to me, is the mature challenge of our time. I'm not disagreeing with you there. I needed to play off of that for the conversation here. Next. That's right. And I would say the not knowing how is not simply because we've forgotten how, but that the community which we are wanting to learn how to make has never been made before. Okay. Community does not mean, the community ahead does not mean the same in the past any more than the love of the future means the same as love past. And we're taking baby steps in the same way around community as we are around intimacy. and a really interesting laboratory of that for me is each year as part of the training aspect of the Institute, I bring together 16 people who share being people with a lot of capacitance. They're very creative, innovative people in their own spheres with a lot of social commitment, and we work over the course of a whole year together, 10 weekends over the course of the year, exploring very personally and in terms of questions of relationship, in terms of larger questions of culture. But it's fascinating to have this group of people in the room working that closely, working over that length of time, people with a great deal of capacity to work. And one of the questions that very naturally comes to the fore, which is, what are we as a community together? And as we explore that question, it becomes very palpable that of how much we are infants in knowing this new sense of community. I mean, it's like early on, it's like you can feel people sort of wanting, let's have some community real fast at the beginning of the year, because folk want community and want to feel close. But then what's really clear, if one allows that to happen very quickly, the sense of individuality of the people gets diminished, and then the system has to fight against that and go out the other way. So, for example, I have a style as a leader in which I do very little that's community building, because I know that that process is going to happen. And I'd say it's going to be the fifth or sixth weekend before there's a sense of community happening there, because the kind of community we're wanting is a community of individuals, a community of whole people, and that's something we've not known how to do before. So I'm wary of a rushing back to the romanticism of old community. You know, community in the past has been based on blood ties and shared dogmas. And if we don't step into a new territory of community, if we move back to community, that's what we get. And we get ethnic strife, and we get, okay. So that, to me, there's a whole new territory of community that we have to, that's one of the most important questions of the future, and that we have to be humble to. I mean, I would say there's no way to deal with the education crisis separate from being able to have communities again. But, you know, that's a huge topic. But community has to mean something that it's meant before. So it's a big challenge. So what you're saying is that we have had a mature relationship to nature in the past, and so basically it's going back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a way in practical terms what I would agree with you. I think in the big picture, I really wouldn't. And that is, I would say, maybe an analogy would be, you know, in our growing up, when we're in the womb and we're infants, we're one with our mother, okay? And in growing up, we have to push away during adolescence to separate and individuate. And then there becomes a time when we can reconnect in a kind of whole person intimacy with our mother again. And one could say that that's something one once had, that degree of intimacy with one's mother. But there's also a difference between being an infant with one's mother and being later in one's life with one's mother. And at least as I experience it, there's a similar philosophical piece we're playing with. It's like there's a polarity that evolves in our creative relationship with nature. And if we go to the earliest times in nature, in a sense, we were one in the mother of nature. And then increasingly, as a civilization, we have separated our individuality and the structures and institutions of culture off away from that mother of nature. But I don't think the task is simply to collapse the institutions of culture into nature. The task is a new kind of saying, what is this larger story of nature in which humanity is an important and unique voice in that story of nature. So we may, it is certainly a remembering, it is certainly a reconnecting, it is certainly an honoring of that nurturing, and my sense of it is it's a different state. Okay, I'd even argue, just to play up it a little bit, that maybe, and I'm a very strong environmentalist, and I was born in the Northwest and have generations back before that, but I think one of the lessons that environmentalists are needing to learn to be effective in times ahead is that we have this polarity of nature and humanity, and often environmentalism simply replaces the sort of siding of technology against nature with a siding of nature against technology. And in the name of a love of nature, in fact, there's a kind of violence in there. There's a kind of not seeing how big the whole is. And it may not alter one's actions terribly to make that shift within one's psyche, but it really alters the effect. I mean, an example, I work around environmental things a lot. And take the example of loggers out on the Olympic Peninsula. It's we can easily get the polarization of the loggers and the trees. But I go out and talk with loggers on the Olympic Peninsula, and these folks are confused. It's like these are not bad people. I mean, these are. And they look, you people are identifying with nature and saying we're against nature. We grew up with stories of Paul Bunyan. We thought we were the nature people, okay? Now, and it's like that diffuses my polarization at that time. Well, does that mean I make a different decision about what should happen with old growth forests? Well, it doesn't for me, because my sense is that we either stop cutting old growth now, or we stop cutting it in 15 years when there's nothing left. We might as well do it now and have some. But the fact that I got past that polarity and can say what we're talking about is not a return to nature, but we're talking about a larger creative whole of humanity and nature in a new kind of relationship, it then has me have a compassion for the situation of the loggers and probably be much more creative in terms of ways to bring them into that conversation and to have a compassionate outcome in their lives with it. So anyway, I spun way off, having no idea of where you were coming from or whatever, but we're in conversation. Make a last one, sure. Uh-huh. Really? Where is that available? Is it? Is anybody else seeing that? Ah. Really? That's great. Somebody else. Nice observation. And I think a very powerful distinction is I think what's also being asked of us is much more than just a kind of liberal or humanistic, let's see these other people as people. But the task is to see them as what they are, which is unique. I can, another spin off of the training piece I do through the Institute each year. One thing I do in my selection process is I very, very carefully select not just for high capacitance, but for maximum diversity of the people who make up the group. And that's maximum diversity not just in terms of professions, but in terms of personality styles. Okay? Now, to me, one of the pieces that's a challenge of our time is that if we look at different personality styles as sort of like different colors in the spectrum, it's remarkable to the degree most of us have been able to shape our lives to be in institutions and settings that involve people who are the same one or two colors that we are, and we don't see the larger picture. And I would also make an argument with that universally the critical emergent question are whole spectrum questions. they need all those colors of the spectrum, all those voices to grapple with them. And that's not from a liberal, isn't it wonderful, let's all like each other and be here place. It's that I need your difference to help make the whole that we need to do this. So it makes doing the intensive a hell of a lot harder than it would be otherwise, because you've got all these people who would never be in the same room together before. On the other hand, we couldn't do what we need to do if all those players weren't in the room. So there's a process of really learning to feel our connection and also learning to be amazed at how different we are and saying, how are you unique and different to me? And how can you help learn, how can you help me fill out who I am by learning about those parts in you? And I'll never be who you are. Isn't that interesting, Kim?
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.